Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Josh Elliott Wolf here filling in for Drance. Drancer will be back on Monday. We're live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. Now joining us from NHL.com and InGoal Magazine, he's a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. He is Kevin Woodley. Woodley, thanks for doing this. How are you?
I'm good. What does it say that I've seen Drance more at Shambar than I have at the rink over the last couple of weeks?
Nothing good, I'm sure. Nothing good whatsoever. Yeah, he's had some time off recently.
Resting up for the postseason.
Let's hope.
Eh?
Let's hope.
He's anticipating a long run, I guess.
He's getting a mental reset in.
How positive he is about all
exactly,
these things.
Exactly, yeah.
So I think he's gearing up.
That's right. All right, speaking of gearing up for the playoffs, I mean, we've heard a lot from Rick talking about how he wants the Canucks to be doing that. Another bit of a tougher offensive outing for them last night. You know, we saw what they did against the Kings as well, how the Kings kind of really shut down their offensive attack. What are you seeing in terms of just their profile of shots and how they're going about trying to generate offense over the last little bit here?
Well, I think we've talked all year long about, you know, where the underlying profile was offensively. As impressive as it's been defensively, and as much as that tends to be a great indicator of success, especially 5-on-5 come playoffs, the offensive numbers haven't been flattering throughout. You know, even accounting for, and I've been one of the guys that talks a lot about how well they manage screens and traffic, and by the way, Besser, who has become one of the premier net front guys in the NHL. Every time I see him away from the net on the power play, I ask why. Even with all those things into consideration, they were still sort of, you know, in the high to mid 20s. Of late, you know, say since if you look at, use the acquisition late January of Elias Lindholm, I guess that would be around the All-Star break too. Like, we're talking now in the 29s. You know, like third or fourth worst team in the NHL in terms of underlying offensive profile. So I think we've known, and there's been a lot of talk about the importance of the power play, and it's been a conversation for a long time, but I think as those chances dry up offensively, even with the things they do well, you're going to probably need more. I think it's pretty clear now, need more from this power play come the playoffs, because there are a couple things that happen here. Once we get closer to and into the playoffs, you tend not to have any bad goaltending that you run into. And most of the teams that are there with you also have better underlying defensive numbers. Like, you're not feasting on the, you know, for lack of a better term, minnows defensively of the NHL. Like, you get an opportunity to at times during the regular season. You're not seeing backup goaltenders. You're seeing the guys that have been at the best from start to finish in the year, and you're seeing them every night, and they're going to be focused on taking away the things you do well. And for the Canucks right now, the things they do well offensively is becoming a pretty short list.
You mentioned the power play, and our text box is pointing fingers at essentially everybody, Elias Pettersson, Pew Suter, the system. What is the main issue with this top unit right now? It kind of feels like, to me at least, a lack of confidence with this group of players.
If I had the answer, I'd be honest with you, I probably wouldn't be talking to you guys. Somebody would have hired me by now. There's a lot of talent out there, you know what I mean? And a lot of really smart hockey people trying to figure out how to put it all together. It kind of feels like they're missing a piece. When it was Lindholm before the injury, he's a right shot. So he can't sort of go into that bumper the way Bo Horvat did when this power play was tearing up the league. As much as the team didn't defend well during that time, that was one thing you could always count on. You need a left shot to run it out of that setup. Right now, that left shot is Pew Suter, who, you know, for everything he does do well, offensive upside and finish is not high on that list, right? So, I've talked, you know, it just feels like there's a lot of good components. They just haven't found a way. Excuse me, guys. Don't eat granola before you come on the air. They haven't found a way to sort of put it all together and get them. Like, at times when it's at its most dynamic, there was a lot of movement away from the puck. There was sort of this constant, everybody was moving around, interchangeable parts. Now it feels like at times when they even get to that, they're still looking for one too many passes. I know Tockett wants them to just shoot and create chaos and get to the net front. We haven't seen a lot of that. When was the last time, as much as, you know, one of the staples has been Pettersson on the left flank, when was the last time we saw a one-timer from there? Which isn't just on him, that's on them being able to get him in a shooting position there. I talked about Brock. Like, again, truly has become an elite net front guy, and yet so often because they want to move, shift that right shot off, or at times they've even moved him into the, like, they, he hasn't been the net front guy for this power play, despite the success he's had. So it just feels like there's a struggle there. Maybe it is just as simple as confidence, but just sort of get everyone on the same page and in the right spots to maximize what they have. And like I said, to be honest, at times it feels like they're just missing that one piece that could connect everything else.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I mean, I have to wonder if Lindholm, if and when he does get back on the ice, gets another shot to be the fifth guy on that unit. You know, in terms of what they're doing at 5-on-5 offense, and, you know, as you said, we've talked all year about the emphasis on screens and tip-ins and deflections and, you know, even like multiple layers of screens to take away the goalie's eyes. From in terms of their potential first-round playoff opponents, so, you know, Nashville, L.A., maybe Vegas in there as well, is there a team that profiles as a more favorable matchup if that's your kind of bread and butter, right? Like, whether it's because the goalie struggles with it or their system gives up more of those opportunities, is there a kind of a team where you think, okay, this play, that matchup plays to the Canucks' offensive strengths?
Actually a really good question. And I'll be honest with you, I think it's one that takes more investigation than I've done. As much as you guys know, I like to talk as well as anyone. I don't like to talk out of my ass. So, and I haven't done the research, guys. I would think anecdotally, you know, like there's multiple parts to that, right? Like, A, can you get there against the defense that opponent rolls out? Like, obviously we talked a lot last year about Vegas and the size of their defense and the way they took care of their front of the net. So that's the first part. Are you willing to, can you get there to create that traffic, to create those layers? Two, and this is where, hey, maybe do I look at a Nashville Predators and a UC Saros who isn't on the taller side of the, you know, the goaltending conversation. And is it perhaps easier to take away, say, his eyes versus a Stuart Skinner or even a Cam Talbot who are a lot taller when they're in the net. That might be part of the equation. But then the third part is, you know, and this is the part where I think teams are really going to key on it. Whether that's enough to take him away or not, we'll see, because he's been, you know, arguably the best defenseman in the NHL. Is, you know, we talk about it being a 43% chance. I think it's the last time I checked, that's what the numbers were for the season. If you can create a layered screen and get a puck into the top corner of the net. But getting that shot off, finding the lane, creating that lane up top as a defenseman is a lot easier said than done, and getting that puck through. So, you know, that's the third component. You know, is there, you know, as much as, hey, maybe UC Saros isn't the tallest goalie and that's a guy we can hammer with screens. You know, are you creating that shot if, you know, Ryan O'Reilly's out there in a shutdown role trying to prevent you from getting to the areas you need to at the top of, whether it's a power play or 5-on-5. So, you know, I don't know that it's a simple answer. And it's certainly one that would require a lot more layers of digging. We're so far from, it feels like, even knowing who it's going to be. Yeah. I mean, Vegas passed LA last night, right? Like, there's so many options here that I just feel like I might be wasting my time digging too much into any one, trying to figure out whether they're the best.
In terms of, so when we're looking at these lines lately, I mean, even in the last couple of days, we've seen a lot of shakeups by Rick Tockett, not only in practice, but in pregame yesterday as well. When you're talking about, like, hey, getting those screens, a lot of it feels like timing. And is there a matter of, like, trying to find and give these lines more time to gain chemistry before the playoffs, as opposed to putting them in a blender as often as they have been lately?
It's a fair question. I think one of the only, like, timing is, you're right, Josh, really key to this. But, you know, be honest with you, the only time, well, I shouldn't say the only time, but the place you're most likely to get the ability to sort of manufacture that timing to work off each other is the power play. And we've talked a lot about Brock and JT and how well they work when, you know, JT catches a puck and Brock's taking the, trying to pull the goalie to one specific direction in the exact moment that JT's releasing it. Like, there's been a lot of great interplay between those two in particular on the power play. We've seen goals created 5-on-5 that way with flash screens and moving screens and things like that. But, you know, you don't have the typically the puck control and the time to sort of manufacture those exact sort of, you know, that interplay, that playing off each other to create those types of chances as often. So in terms of the, and I think you have to call it at this point, experimenting, I was a little surprised. I think we all were, to see the way the lines rolled out, you know, last night, yep, especially in a game, you know, against the Dallas Stars with first place in the Western Conference and all the sort of, you know, connotations that came with that matchup. I would say the same of splitting Hronek and Hughes against the Los Angeles Kings, you know, three nights earlier. I think there was a few people scratching their head at the timing of that, you know, in a moment where we hear a lot of talk about, you know, maintaining the focus and the sharpness and not getting caught up in the dog days, knowing that clinching is inevitable and the importance of maintaining first place in the Pacific and home ice advantage and all those things. When you're experimenting to the degree they seem to have in these past couple of games, lineup wise, I don't know that that sends the same message. Not that I think the players are like, oh man, like I'm not playing hard tonight because I'm not playing with the guys. I don't know. Like, that's not the case, but you know, does it create urgency if it feels like you're tinkering, if it feels like you're just trying things out for the postseason? I don't know that it's, I think it's a fair question, because I do think some of those moves, you know, I mean, JT and his, after being so attached at the hip to Brock Besser and the success they've had and all those dynamics I just talked about, to split them up, to split everything up, frankly, just in order to get Bluger, Joshua, and Garland together, when if, and I guess maybe it is an if, but if we take Talkett at his word, Elias Lindholm is coming back, you know, unless you're going to move him to wing, which didn't work great once when you, yep, first got him, Bluger, Garland, and Joshua means what? Elias Lindholm's a fourth-line center? So, you know, there were a lot of, like I said, you know, this group has its reasons. Nothing is done willy-nilly. It's all well thought out. But I think it'll be a fair question that'll be asked, you know, when they get back to practice tomorrow about sort of, you know, some of the thought process behind that at this time of the year. Because I'm with you from a distance. It was easy to second-guess those things. And that said, like, here's the thing. We're talking about, and the offense has eroded somewhat and all these things. You know what's maintained throughout it all? A really strong, stingy, yep, defensive profile that, again, does traditionally bode well for playoff success and has kept them in games against some of the top competition. I mean, last night, all the talk was about the Dallas Stars and, you know, 720 goal scores. Ben could make it eight, a franchise record, just on an absolute roll of late. And that's a 1-1 game until a careless penalty late in the third period, right? So, as much as we are focusing on some of the trends, and it's hard to ignore them, especially offensively, given how long it's lasted in the power play, let's not lose track of the fact that against some elite competition, they are right in these games until late, in part because they are night and day, a completely reverse team from what they were a year ago at this point in terms of how they take care of their own end of the ice. And I think that continues to give them a chance amid all these other questions. And again, tends to, has historically boded well for teams with that type of profile heading into the playoffs. As much as all the other questions are fair, they haven't come out of their structure to chase the offense that's been lacking. And as much as we may bemoan that lack of offense, I think that's a good thing, that they're sticking with what they're supposed to do rather than coming apart and starting to give up some of the odd man rushes and wide open free goals that frankly define this team and this group for way too long.
It's a good point. And, you know, let's also not forget Rick Tocchet's probably going to win the Jack Adams because of that defensive turnaround that he's helped author here in Vancouver. Now, another interesting decision coming up for Tocchet and the coaching staff and goalie coach Ian Clark with the game. They have the afternoon game against the Ducks on Sunday at home. Then they go on the road for a back-to-back with Vegas and Arizona. I know Rick Tocchet yesterday kind of alluded to Archer Seelov's potentially getting a start here. How do you expect to see the goalie usage shake out here over the next three games? And what are, like, from Ian Clark's perspective, what are the considerations that go into planning this three-game stretch out?
Well, I mean, I honestly don't know. Like, I'm curious. I'm just as curious as everyone else because I do think there was a thought that maybe Arturs gets the game on Sunday. Certainly, he's getting one of the back-to-backs, right? Like, yep. I think that's probably a given. I do wonder if, you know, because I think there are times, you know, even right up to the injury where the temptation to, especially in some of the big games that they had against, you know, top tier opponents, Vegas, LA, Winnipeg, the sort of before and leading into the Demko injury, they kept rolling him out there because that was your best chance to win. And it was tough competition and they'd had that 4-game losing streak. And, you know, so I wonder if the fact they didn't get a result against LA, they didn't get a result against Dallas and, hey, no fault of Casey DeSmith, who I thought was really good last night against the Stars. I wonder if that affects their thinking. I genuinely don't know. But do they want to stick with Casey tomorrow against Anaheim until they get that check mark and do it with a win that sort of puts them in? And as much as it's a formality, we see where Edmonton is. We see that gap closing. Do you err more towards not putting Arturs into a game with all that extra pressure on it? And my hunch is, you know, Ian Clark isn't, if he believes that Arturs can handle it, he won't hesitate to recommend playing him. If you saw any decline in Casey's game in terms of the need for rest and fatigue settling in, I don't think they'd hesitate to play Arturs, but I don't know that I've seen that. So your guess is as good as mine in terms of which way they go. I do wonder if the results the other night make it more likely to be Casey again on Sunday before splitting the back-to-back on the road. It is, again, it's pro sports, so pressure is a part of this, and Seelof on big stages at World Championships has delivered in the past, but making his first start of the NHL in the NHL this season and his first start in what? Well over 2 weeks now, a game that, you know, has those type of playoff implications on it in an afternoon start tomorrow. I wonder if they just stick with the guy that's been going well in Casey DeSmith.
What have you thought of Casey DeSmith in the stretch since he's taken over? I know some of the concern that I've seen online has been the rebound control, but what do you think of his overall play?
I think he's had some, you know, he's had some games where he's made some really, I was trying to think, it was like 3 games ago where, you know, some really, really, really tough saves. The one before Calgary where, you know, point blank stuff in the slot, he was really good. I think it was the Montreal game was his best. Are there moments where the speed with which he gets around his crease, which is a big part of his game, and I've kind of talked about this since Montreal rolled into town, actually. It was based on a conversation with Caden Primo, who talked about, you know, skating with him and Jake Allen in the summer and how him and Jake couldn't believe how fast Casey was. And I think watching him every day, maybe I've even taken for granted how quick he gets around the ice. But, you know, on those backdoor plays, the bang-bang chances, there are times when that speed, you get to your spot and you're moving with a lot of pace and it's hard to contain it. And there's been a few times, you know, I think Kings game where he kind of ends up pushing himself out of the net. There was one in the Montreal or the Washington game on the Ovechkin tap-in where he came charging out on a low high play. There's been a few of those, but I think for the most part, he's kept it contained. He showed off that speed. He's made some point blank saves, rebound control. You know, at times, there are times when you just need the first one, right? Like there are some shots where it's like, hey, it's a high nadir chance and you just want to make the first save, and where the puck ends up is where it ends up, and they've done a great job in front of him. There have been other ones, the one that went out of his glove before the Kopitar goal, even though that's a point blank look from Kopitar on the initial one, anytime it's in the pocket, obviously I'm sure he'd tell you he'd like to squeeze it. And listen, this the rebound thing is something that I talked about at the beginning of the season. You know, there is a lot of second chance opportunities. I thought last night there was early in the season. I think it's something he's gotten better at, but there is also not every rebound is a bad rebound, not just because of the quality of chance, but he does do a really good job for the most part of keeping them in front of him. And so if I spill a rebound off to the side for a back door, that's a bad rebound. If I keep it in front of me, as much as you don't want any rebounds, the ones in front of me are, even at clear sight, you would classify it as a good rebound because I'm in position for the next one. And so there are times where it can feel a little scrambly because of those, but they're not all necessarily, you know, bad rebounds, even if in a perfect world you'd like to see every puck controlled. It's just not the reality for goaltenders in today's league.
Kevin, really appreciate it, man. Thanks for doing this on Good Friday. Have a great weekend, and keep an eye out for Drance at Shambar.
Yeah, I only get to go like once a year with my. That's a special treat for us. So I don't know if that's like just he looked really settled in and casual, like it was a regular thing for him. So I don't know what you guys are paying him over there, but it might be too much.
Yeah, apparently it is. Have a great weekend, man.
You too.
That is Kevin Woodley from NHL.com In Goal Magazine here, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George in White Rock or WhiteRockHyundai.com. It's a good point there that that he makes about the question of whether or not to start Artur Seelovs.
That Drance gets paid too much, you mean?
Well, good that's a great point. I've been saying that for years. If you'd already clinched, like it's still a game against the Ducks, so it's not like, oh, it's high pressure, but you haven't clinched yet. So it's kind of let's take care of this, and then you factor in that you're trying to hold off Edmonton for the Pacific Division. I still think you just, if that was your plan, go for it, put him in there. Mm-hmm. Don't let that bother you, but it does make it a little bit more difficult to just with full confidence put him in that spot compared to if you'd won at least one of these last two games against LA or Dallas.
And maybe it doesn't matter because, like we said, there's a backdoor way of
there sure
tomorrow
is.
Without the Canucks even doing anything.
Go San Jose, beat the Blues.
I believe. But that being said, like, I don't know. I have no issue starting him against Anaheim. And look, I know there's pressure, quote unquote, because you are trying to clinch, but at the same time, is there really that much pressure?
Like, yeah,
you know, you're going to clinch.
Yeah.
And I think it would be better to get him in for that game just so that he's ready for playing the back to back as well. And realistically, like, playing the Anaheim Ducks is low pressure.
You'd give him the Ducks and the Coyotes.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. I have no problem with that whatsoever. By the way, you made this point to me before the show. If people haven't been paying attention, Sharks have 40 points in 72 games. They're minus 135.
They're so bad.
They're
at
almost
hockey.
Minus two goals a game. That's wild.
That's determination. Like, that's, hey, we know Macklin Celebrini. We want him.
Like, they are 36 goals worse than the Blackhawks. Who are minus 99.
We're also
bad
at
awful.
Hockey. Yeah.
And that's the number, that's the second worst team. And they're like clear from them by a mile in terms of goal differential.
There are levels to the poorness, and San Jose is way at the bottom.
Yikes, yikes, yikes. All right, we'll take a break here. Ryan Clark from ESPN will take a spin around the NHL, get his thoughts on some of the playoff races and storylines going into the playoffs. Up next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Josh Elliott-Wolf here. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Now joining us on the phone from ESPN covering the NHL, he is Ryan Clark. Ryan, thank you as always for doing this, and congratulations on ducking a conversation with Thomas Drance.
Oh, well, for sure. Thanks for having me. Second, talking to Drance is always fun just because it's always fascinating just to hear him talk and just kind of get a feel for it. So that's what's going on between your ears today. And some days you're just like, oh, okay. And then other days you're like, oh, okay. But knowing him, he'll be like, that's a compliment, and I'll put it on my mantle. So, yeah, I'm going to stop there.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I think that was a good way to sum it up, right? If you just view it as like a sociological experiment, then it's it becomes really, really fascinating. So the Canucks have lost their last couple of games here against Dallas, against L.A., and, you know, the conversation from Rick Tocchet has been he's trying to get this team ramped up, get them ready for the playoffs. Looking across the Western Conference right now, who's the scariest team, the team that should frighten other teams the most in the Western Conference going into the playoffs?
It's funny because you could argue this question had been asked 24 hours ago. Maybe it's the Nashville Predators, but of course we saw what happened to them last night against the Coyotes. The point can be made, it's still the Predators are in that conversation, but if you had to pick one, it's probably the Dallas Stars. You're talking about a team that's won 6 in a row, 8 of its last 10. It's a group that's seen not only consistency from its lineup, but it's getting contributions from all over the different parts of its lineup. You look at what the Tanev addition has meant in terms of giving Miro Heiskanen that right-handed partner that could keep up with him. That gives them this true shutdown line. So you would say the Stars. But again, like to that point about, hey, look, teams that are just in this interesting, you know, space. Like you think about the Canucks, yes, they've lost 2 in a row, but they've still won 6 of their last 10. The Avs have lost 2 in a row, but they still won 8 of their last 10. So it's kind of an interesting time because not even just in the West, but you look at the East where for so long, everybody's been like Florida, Florida, Florida. And then, of course, there's what Paul Maurice said last night about free quote night because he wasn't impressed with the way they played. So, again, it seems like it's just late March, early April in the NHL.
And with the Stars specifically, it just kind of feels like there's no weaknesses on the team anymore, especially like you mentioned after the addition of Tanev. It's like they're just kind of relentless. I don't know if they have the high-end skill of a Colorado or an Edmonton, but it's just relentless pressure, and there's no weak matchups with them.
Well, if there is a question that you do have with them, and it's kind of a bizarre one to ask, it would be Jake Oettinger, maybe not lately with the way he's played over his last 4 starts, but you think about the year that he's having as a save percentage below 90, which is bizarre to think because, and this is what's so interesting about the Stars. You think about the evolution they've had over the last few years where that playoff series against the Calgary Flames, Oettinger was one of the reasons they even made it as far as they did, but there was this understanding of you've got to be able to get more support. A year later, they're able to get that support. They're able to get to the Western Conference Finals. And they're within a few games of going to the Cup Final. Whereas if you look at them now, and like, yes, while they might not have, let's say, the high-end skill that some teams have or the consistent high-end skill, what they may not have, they have in other places. And now, like, there is a depth in terms of what they do. Like, Robertson, Pavelski, Deschene, Hintz, Johnston, Marchment, Seguin, these are all 20-goal scorers, which was the case last year. Jamie Benn is 2 away from 20. Thomas Harley is 5 away from 20. Zadonov, again, he's only played 50 games, but 23 and 50. Like, these are numbers that are bigger. Even, hey, we think about Craig Smith and what he was in Nashville. Craig Smith has 10 goals this year. And you think about what he's been through. And so that's just it. It's like, it's a team that it really can rely on a lot of different people for offensive contributions. And what we saw last year with Vegas was, look, for all of Vegas' stars, the strength of what Vegas did was it could rely on everyone in the lineup, and it seems like the Stars could be the same way.
Well, and yeah, you know, you go through the list, and then they call up Logan Stankoven, and he's played like a 20-plus goal scorer since he's been in the league for them. So just another weapon in the arsenal there for Pete DeBoer and the Dallas Stars. So last night, as you mentioned, Colorado loses, and, you know, more surprising than that, Nathan MacKinnon's home point streak, which was active since the beginning of the season, finally comes to an end. Despite that, though, still a pretty good year. 123 points through 73 games so far. He's shouldering an incredible burden, playing a career high in terms of minutes per game. Is he the Hart Trophy front runner for you right now?
It's interesting because I was actually just flew back from Denver for a story we are doing on Nathan MacKinnon. And to be at the game last night, it was sort of the controversial topic of, like, how does he not get an assist? And not that it necessarily turns into the Zapruder film, but everyone's looking at different angles of, like, how is this not an assist? Or is this an assist? Or how do you define assist? And it's like, oh, great, it's the NFL with what to catch. But to be serious, he's very much in that conversation. Of course, what it comes back to this time of year is just it's how do you look at the Hart Trophy? Do you look at it, of course, over the whole season, what people do sort of to help their team get into the playoffs or remain in the playoff chase? And it seems like there's a handful of names that keep coming up, but there's him, Kucherov, and McDavid. And at this point, it's so hard to say, like, who the favorite would be because they each present a compelling case. Like, yes, McDavid has been one of the best players in the league, but you're seeing a creative level of what he does to where it's more than just his goals that are kind of helping power the Edmonton Oilers. You think about Nikita Kucherov, and it's wild to sit here and think that at one point in time, we were asking if the Tampa Bay Lightning were going to make the playoffs, but as we've seen from them, they've looked like that team that has been a persistent, perennial threat, and he's been at the heart of that, especially when defensively it hasn't always been as consistent as it's been in years past. Whereas if, like with Nathan MacKinnon, you look at what he's doing, the fact that he's doing this going on now year two without Gabriel Landeskog in terms of the regular season. And not only that, but it's just this is a team that's had to make adjustments on the fly. You think about what this was at the beginning of the season with players like Ryan Johansson, Jonathan Drouin, Ross Colton, Miles Wood sort of like finding their place. And while three of those players have been able to find consistency, they move on from Johansson. They bring in Casey Mittelstadt. They bring in Don Walker. They're able to get Zach Parise as a free agent signing, and they're able to change the dimensions of that team to where, again, until their last two games, and even then losing to the Rangers in a shootout, that's far from the worst loss in the world. Like, this is still a team that looked really, really, really ready to go on a run. So, again, in terms of who it could be, all those arguments that were just presented just show, like, why it could be a tight race again this year.
What have you thought of all those additions for Colorado? Like, before the deadline, I think we were all looking at it like, hey, they don't have the depth. Maybe they're a team that won't go as far as we might have thought preseason, and then they kind of just shore up all their weaknesses, all their holes on the roster. How have those additions fit in for Colorado, and what can they do for them in the postseason?
Well, for now, what it's done is whenever there are these questions about can you get more beyond MacKinnon, Rantanen, and Makar, you're starting to see the answer to that be yes. Like, Casey Mittelstadt has been able to perform well as a second-line center. What you're getting on the edge from players like Trennan and Duhaime, with guys like Nichushkin being out of the lineup, is you're still getting that physical component, and you're getting people who can chip in with offensive contributions as well. Like, there was a point in the game last night against the Rangers where, like, Zach Parise won a foot race and had one of the better scoring chances in that game. And so, like, when you're being able to see those sorts of players not only contribute, but contribute consistently, it goes into sort of what's been this interesting dynamic the Avalanche have had since Jared Bednar has been there, which is when you look at players who come from the outside, the overwhelming majority of them go to Colorado, and not only do they perform and perform well, but they have career years. Nazem Kadri, Andre Burakovsky, Jonas Donskoy is another name that comes to mind. So again, like, these are things that we've seen over time, that what we're seeing this year is you're seeing the contributions of a Ross Colton. You're seeing the contributions of a Miles Wood. Like, you're seeing Casey Mittelstadt. And of course, it's just a question of what is it look like in the playoffs. With Ross Colton, we know what that looks like with the playoffs. Casey Mittelstadt's a little bit more of a bigger question. Same thing with Don Walker. But again, like, with what they're doing, you could argue it's starting to feel maybe a little bit reminiscent of what they were 2 years ago in terms of building that depth and having it work in several different levels.
Talking to Ryan Clark from ESPN here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. And I know you mentioned the tough loss for Nashville against Arizona yesterday. And hey, they were going to drop the full 2 points at some point here before the end of the regular season. But given the run they were just on and the way that team's been playing, especially since, you know, the trade deadline, are you buying Nashville as a real threat in the Western Conference?
Fascinating, because that conversation keeps coming up of, like, who are the teams you don't want to play right now? And of course, the gorilla in the room is Vegas, because it's like, well, if they get everyone healthy,
yep,
given what they were last year, that's one. But Nashville is another, because you think about, okay, yes, there's that top line of what they can do with Forsberg, O'Reilly, and Gustav Nyquist, but then you think about what they're able to do beyond that. Colton Sissons is having an extremely strong year. Tommy Novak is having the kind of year that's seen him get rewarded. Luke Evangelista's name might not come up for a lot of people in the Calder discussion, but he's been a consistent contributor on both ends, especially as the season's gone on for them. And then when you look at their blue line and what they're able to do, yes, we talk about the Norris and the fact it seems like, hey, this is going to be Quinn Hughes' award. But the more you watch Roman Josi this year, You're just like, are people recognizing how strong of a season he's been having? You think about him, you think about McDonough. Again, it's just all these different options. I mean, you see Staros on the back end. And the Predators have a lot of different things going to seem dangerous. And it goes back to something we learned for a story we had on ESPN not that long ago, where it's like there was this system that they wanted, and it was just a matter of being patient. And once guys understood what it meant to play in that system, it's why they've been able to go on this run. They've talked about being relentless to where, like, you look at Andrew Brunette's teams. When he was in Florida, they led the league in goals when he was the interim head coach. He goes to the Devils as an assistant last year. They're a top five scoring team. And the thought is that teams are about goals, goals, goals. But yet when you sit here and hear his philosophies and how players understand those philosophies, you get to understand that, yes, getting the puck is important, but there's this understanding that in order for it to work, you've got to consistently forecheck. We hear teams talk about that all the time, but with Nashville, it's very much a part of its identity. And what you're seeing now, stands last night, is that's the result of this. This is a team that not only has this identity, but it's an identity that gets results.
Is that a style of play that you think like translates to the playoffs, though? Because I think a lot of people look at these defensive-heavy teams, and they're like, hey, that's the team that's going to do damage when they get to the postseason. But and you mentioned the Florida when Brunette was there and the Devils, and obviously they didn't make it very far with Brunette. But could it be different in Nashville this time around?
You get the feeling it could be, just because to hear this conversation about using the forecheck to create offensive opportunities and regain control of the puck, that's been Colorado's philosophy under Jared Bednar. It's what the Golden Knights did under Bruce Cassidy. Those are the last two teams that have won. Because you hear coaches talk about how, look, everybody wants the puck and guys want the puck, but it's just about how do you get that way. And it's getting them to understand the defensive responsibilities. And, yes, you're hearing more coaches say that, but at the same time, like, when they're able to sort of reflect it in the sense of, like, explaining why it matters, and this is possibly going to be a bizarre analogy, but it seems like it used to be getting guys to be, like, bought in and defensively was almost sort of like, okay, but if you do this, you'll get what you want, and sort of like this push-pull dynamic. Whereas the more players you talk to, especially that are coming up now, everybody's been told you've got to be a 200-foot player, and there's no way around it. You can only do so much, but if you really want to go far in this league, you have to be a 200-foot player. And when you think about Nashville's identity of trying to be this 200-foot team, they have a Selke Trophy winner in Ryan O'Reilly who understands that better than anyone. But where it really gets interesting in terms of how they understand it, it is hearing Roman Josi talk about it, and it's hearing him say, like, the investment and the buy-in that the forwards have taken into the system. It's something that it's made life not only easy for the defensive, but it's like you can see a real five-skater cohesion. And so to hear it, like, yes, they're saying the things that make anyone who hears them go, could they be for real? But it's like anything. It's about what they do in the playoffs. And as we've all seen, rarely do you see a team that just comes in and they go from missing the playoffs last year to they're going to win the cup this year. There's a progression into that point. So it's a matter of seeing what that progression holds for the Predators. And knowing this show, something says we're about to get that similar question, but about the Vancouver Canucks.
How dare you? But yes, I was thinking that. But yeah, I mean, and it's especially kind of front of mind for me right now, Ryan, because Rick Tocchet's been very vocal about where his team's mentality needs to be and the fact that it's, in his eyes, it's not really there right now in terms of the intensity and just the battle level in these games, the compete level. And is that something that you think looms even larger for Rick Tocchet coaching a team that doesn't have that experience in the playoffs, right? That they need more than maybe some other teams to get there ahead of the playoffs because they do have that inexperience factor and it might be harder to kind of flip the switch come game one.
It's possible, but it's also just the whole idea, again, of like when you look at the teams that have been considered to be the front runners for the cup this year, the majority of them have had to cross some sort of hypothetical or proverbial Rubicon to get to this point. So let's just take two random teams. We've talked about the Carolina Hurricanes being contenders for a long while,
yep.
And they've gone through their challenges. But of course, the thing they've done this year is they made the sort of trade for Jake Guentzel back. Historically, that's just not something that they've done with great regularity. And so it's like, is this like that aha moment where it sort of works? in the Western Conference, that team right now we just talked about was the Dallas Stars. And with the Canucks, it's like, what is sort of that next step in their evolution? Like, is it getting to the playoffs? Is it winning the first round? And if it is, then what's the expectation from there? Because, like, yes, the regular season is something that they've mastered this year. But going back to what we were saying about Andrew Brunette in Florida, the Florida Panthers had done that as well, but it wasn't really until they were able to get beyond the first round is when you started to understand their identity. And their identity was, this is a team that could score. But, like, is this a team that can score in those big games against a proven team like a Tampa? Do they have enough here? Do they have enough there? Can they get consistency in other areas? And what you saw last year before they played the Golden Knights was they were able to get that consistency. But, again, they just lacked the bodies because they kept getting hurt. Whereas until recently, you looked at the Panthers, and it's like they have every question answered. And so if you're looking at the Canucks, like, yes, you have all the talent, all this ability, but in terms of how it's going to work out in a seven-game series, like, that's the million-dollar question, and that can all depends upon who they end up playing in the first round. If they end up playing Vegas, how do you look at that? Because on one hand, like, yes, they might be the higher seed, but also Vegas is the defending champions that just had the sort of deadline that it's very clear what the mission is. If they don't end up playing Vegas, and let's say they end up playing Nashville, we just spent minutes talking about why Nashville could be this looming threat. But again, it's a matchup of two teams that, like, they're trying to get to the next level. It's just that when you look at the Predators, they've had players like McDonough and O'Reilly who've won. They've had guys like Nyquist who've been in the league for a bit who understand these things. Whereas if on the flip side with the Canucks, like, you do have that with some of your players, like an Ian Cole who've won a cup. But you look at the heart of what you do, like, this would be, again, a new experience in terms of trying to get to those next levels for players like Quinn Hughes, for players like Elias Pettersson. And that's where, again, it gets interesting for the Vancouver Canucks.
Ryan, you're such a good Canucks Talk guest. You're setting up the questions and then answering them as well. So thank you for that. I enjoyed that. Thanks as always, man. Have a great Easter weekend.
Hey, thanks. You guys do the same. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. That is Ryan Clark from ESPN covering the NHL. And the point he makes there towards the end about, you know, the what we kind of think of as the classic progression of contending teams, where you almost have to go through that disappointment in the playoffs to get to the Stanley Cup, to become a true Stanley Cup contender. I find that so fascinating to think about in the context of these Canucks, and especially when we start to think, you know, we're so close to the playoffs now, when we start to think, like, what should the expectations be for this team? What will qualify as a successful playoff run? What will be a really big disappointment? And I know it's tempting to look at this and say, well, it's their first time really going to the playoffs, and so that should really temper expectations. Mm-hmm. And I get that, but I also think that because this team is not your traditional, oh, it's their first time going to the playoffs team, right? Where they're super, super young and, like, got this, you know, got these great prospects coming, and they, you know, their best players still have time to mature and all that. Not that their best players are old necessarily, but they're not, like, really, really young on their ELCs or even
they're in their prime.
They're in their prime right now, right? Mm. So it's not as if you can just easily forecast and say, like, well, you know, they lose in the first round. Hey, it's great experience. They'll be better next year. We don't know that. They've got so much uncertainty going into the summer. And then you factor in, again, it's not as if they were scrapping to get into the seventh or the eighth seed. They've been top of the league for most of the year. They made a big pre-deadline acquisition, sent out some significant assets. So they're such an atypical playoff team. But I look at it in total, and as much as I understand the idea that, well, you know, it's their first time in the playoffs, so that should lower expectations, I think when you've been this good all season and you've spent as much as they have on making the team good this season, I think the expectations need to be higher than they would normally for a kind of breakthrough first-time playoff team.
Yeah, and you kind of hit the nail on the head. Like, if you went through the deadline and you didn't add, and you essentially were like, hey, we're playing with house money right now, things are going really well, and that's great, but we'll see how things go in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. Then I could be sold on, hey, this is a year of experience, you're trying to, you know, gain that and maybe progress on it in the future. If we're looking at a year where it was like, hey, this was the year that you got the taste of the playoffs, I know it's been a while, but that was the bubble. And that was when guys were younger, and ready to take that next step. You messed up the next couple years, and that's okay. Well, it's not okay.
Oh!
It happened. It happened.
It's in the past. There's nothing we can do about it now.
Now it's like, hey, it's go time. And especially when you add someone like Elias Lindholm at the deadline, like the one of the top two deadline acquisitions in terms of overall impact, theoretically, going into the season.
Well, certainly in terms of acquisition cost given up to get him. And the thing that I come back to is, from management's perspective, I don't believe they do that deal unless they thought the team had a legitimate chance to win the Stanley Cup, right? Like, you don't do that deal for a team that you think is probably going to lose in the first round. Mm-hmm. You obviously, you're not doing that. If you think, like, that's our real level, that's not the year to go spend big at the deadline or ahead of the deadline. So I think the fact that those internal expectations existed, that the team had played well enough to raise those expectations from management, should kind of guide how we feel about it. And look, I get, you know, Drance has made the point, we've had this debate a little bit, that management has been so successful from a team building perspective this year that almost whatever happens in the playoffs, you still look at it as a success because you have that confidence. And I get that. I do understand that. And obviously there's different ways to lose in the first round. There's different ways to go out that could be more or less disappointing. And it would be one thing if, you know, Dakota Joshua was under contract and Filip Hronek was under contract at a number you liked, and there was a lot of more certainty, and there was a guy knocking down the door to make the jump from the AHL that you thought would have a really significant impact, then I could buy into that. I just can't escape the concern that this might be your best shot with Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes and JT Miller all having these types of years. And if you go out in the first round, I don't see how it isn't going to feel like a big missed opportunity.
Yeah, regardless of team, like, even if you match up against Vegas or LA, whoever in the first round, it's going to be disappointing. We were talking about a pre-show. I do think if you matched up against Nashville and lost,
that would be tough.
It would be a bit extra disappointing.
A team featuring Anthony Beauvillier would be tough. Yeah. That would be tough.
I completely forgot that Beauvillier was in Nashville.
He was one of their big deadline acquisitions.
That hurts. If they beat you, that would be tough, man. Anthony Beauvillier, game 7, OT winning goal.
The big revenge goal. Popping the Preds crest.
Alvin's like, I knew it! Yeah, that would suck. I what's the barometer for non-disappointment then? Is it winning a round and then being competitive
in
the second round?
I think if you win a round and you're competitive in the second round, obviously it's always disappointing when your team loses in the playoffs, but I think that shuts the door on any, like, they were wrong to go for it, or see, they were frauds all along. Like, no. Yeah. You win a round, you're competitive in the second round. At that point, you're one of the last 8 teams. And who are you going to be playing in the second round? Like, Edmonton or Vegas or LA?
Yeah.
What? You're going to be choked about losing in 6 or 7 to them? Like, come on.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand they could lose in 6 or 7 to LA or Vegas in the first round as well. It's just, it's just going to feel so anticlimactic if they lose in the first round.
The other part of it is, like, we're talking about the experience and gaining it. Like, that's an extra round of playoff experience.
It's a great
if
point.
You get there.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. That's where I'm at, is win a round, be competitive in the second round,
100% agree.
And I'm fine with it.
And then it's, okay, you justified making the move. You were actually a good team, and then we can turn our attention to the summer. But I think you have to win that first round, or else, boy, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough times. All right, final segment of the week coming up here on a Good Friday edition of Canucks Talk. I want to talk a little bit about the forward lineup structure. We got some texts in with some suggestions about how Rick Tocchet and the coaching staff should figure things out. And who are the team's most important wingers? Dakota Joshua comes back to the lineup with a bit of a statement game last night. Who are these team's best, most important wingers? We'll talk about that next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Josh Elliott Wolf here filling in for Drance. Drance will be back on Monday, I think. Pretty sure.
Will he?
As I said that, I was like, I don't know.
Let me check for you.
But I'm pretty sure
he will be.
All right, there you go. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with 3 stores to serve you. in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. Happy Easter weekend to everyone. You big Easter guy, Josh?
What do you mean?
I don't know.
I guess like I celebrate
answer.
Easter.
Just answer the question. Why are you stalling?
I don't know what defines a big Easter guy. We should ask Rick Tockett.
I was going to say, is Rick Tockett a big Easter guy?
Yeah. Big Easter guy. Big Easter guy. Big short-term goal guy and a
big Easter guy.
I'm going out to Chilliwack on Sunday.
Oh, wow.
Celebrate with family and the drones.
And the drones, yes.
And then I think I have some family coming over to my place on Monday from my fiance.
Oh, wow. Hosting duty on Easter. What are you making?
Ham, I think.
Sure.
We'll
classic.
See. Actually,
classic
I don't know if we're planned. Easter is definitely
you should get on that.
Yeah, probably. Easter is definitely a ham over turkey thing, though.
100%. Like, I'm not the biggest ham guy, but I would also feel weird to make a turkey in the spring.
What else would you make for Easter?
I don't know. Like a nice like roast or something.
I guess.
I don't know. Ham just has never really done it for me, but I get it. It's Easter tradition, so, I mean, what are you going to do? All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. So Dakota Joshua comes back to the lineup after what, like a 6 week almost absence. And he's immediately very, very noticeable. And part of that is he's reunited with Teddy Bluger and Connor Garland. And that line was, I thought, easily the Canucks' best line at 5-on-5. But even beyond kind of the interplay and the chemistry with those guys, right? He's bringing that physicality. He made some plays on the penalty kill. I know the PK overall didn't have a great night, but you still saw his impact there. And he's a pending UFA, and I think there's been a lot of focus on the UFA and the RFA situation on the blue line, right? Because it's Cole, it's Myers, Hronek, Zadorov.
There's a lot more there.
Yeah, there's a lot more to take care of. There's a lot more kind of uncertainty. But, you know, you brought up the point before the show. If you just look at this team's winger situation right now, if you were to rank the wingers in terms of importance, best, whatever you want to say, on this team going into the playoffs, I mean, Joshua would be a lot higher than I think anybody would have had him at the beginning of the season. What would your like top three most important wingers on this team be?
Top three. So I feel like you have to start with Besser just based on like his importance this year. I know he hasn't been as good recently.
I think it's Garland, honestly.
Really?
I do. Like Besser.
But Besser's just got all the goals and
he
stuff.
He does.
He's playing on power play one.
He does. But Besser is ultimately a complimentary player. Right?
Sure.
Like, you're never going to put Brock Besser on a line and be like, he's going to drive that line.
Fair enough.
You can do that with Connor Garland. And I think the third line has been such a lifeline for this team, right? And so much of that comes down to Connor Garland, not discounting what Dakota Joshua and Teddy Bluger have done, but I don't think you're getting anything close to that type of production without Connor Garland in that position. I think it's just that element where he can be the primary guy generating offense on a line that, as much as I like Brock Besser in his game and he's had a fantastic year, he needs Miller, he needs Pettersson to have that success in a way that I don't think Garland does.
Sure. I guess my argument would be like Garland theoretically would get these chances in the top six if he could complement Miller and Pettersson
100%
better
Look, to be fair, being a complementary to skilled players is a skill. So it's not inherently a negative. Like, being able to do that really well is a skill that not every player has.
We've seen guys fail at it.
100%.
Mainly Andre Kuzmic. Besser Garland, I think, for
I think
everyone,
has to be 1-2
one
at this
two.
Point. Yeah.
I am very, very steady in my opinion that Joshua is the third most important winger on this team. And the other names you can throw in there are, like, Nils Höglander.
I think Nils Höglander would be the other guy.
Theoretically, it should be Ilya Mikheyev. It's not, though.
It is definitely not.
It is definitely not Ilya Mikheyev. Joshua, to me, is clearly the third most important winger on this team. I think there's a lot more in his game as well that we just haven't seen yet. And maybe it's never going to be there. Maybe this is his ultimate potential in terms of being an NHL player. But I do feel like there's more offense to give. I feel like if you gave him a shot in the top six, once again, like I said, play him with Miller and Besser, see what happens. I think there's more there, and we see it night in, night out. In terms of importance to the team, Joshua, to me, is number three.
Well, and I think that's fair. I mean, I think you could make a case for Nils Höglander And certainly, I mean, he's having a fantastic offensive year as well. I think you could say Joshua, because he contributes on special teams as well in a way that Hoglander doesn't, that might give him the edge. The thing with Joshua, because he's a pending unrestricted free agent, the top six thing is so important. And really, like, this is a high risk, high reward evaluation for the team to make here. Because I know Rick Dhaliwal was on Halford and Brough today saying, you know, this guy could get $3+ million with term on the open market. Like, teams around the league are taking notice of what he's doing. He was on pace for 20 goals. We've said a bunch of times on this show, like, all it's going to take is a couple of big playoff moments for him to really, you know, draw the attention of everyone around the league. And if you're talking, like, you know, $3.5 million over 4 years for a strictly bottom six player, for a guy whose ceiling is the you know, being a part of a good third line, that probably makes you a little nervous. But if all of a sudden you think, like, hey, if we stick that this guy in the top six, we think we can get 20 goals out of him, maybe even on a consistent basis, well, then you're looking at, like, I don't want to say a bargain necessarily, but something that has the potential to be really, really valuable, especially if the cap shoots up all of a sudden. So I think, like, Joshua, more than anyone else, you need to decide internally, is this guy, can we win? Do we feel really good about having this guy in our top six, or is he strictly bottom six? Because if you, if the answer is yes, we feel good about our chances of winning and being a contender with him in our top six, then I think you go get that deal done. Absolutely.
Yeah. Even if he's a third line guy, and the third line, I guess the other part of this is it's hard to predict that that third line is going to be this good year in, year out.
Teddy Bluger is a UFA.
Yeah. Well, what I will say is we did see Pugh Suter start there.
You're
when
right.
That third line
right.
started going.
And but, like, I don't know. Would it shock you if they traded Connor Garland in the summer?
No.
No.
No. I guess it wouldn't. But that being said, I still think that, again, there's more to give from Joshua. And that's why I'd be very okay with a contract like that personally. And the other thing I kind of want to see from him that I put out last night is some time on the power play. It's weird that he isn't getting power play two time at least.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind seeing him, and hey, maybe you don't want to mess with Besser at the net front on the power play, but hey, maybe messing with the power play is fine.
But they've
right
been moving Besser around a lot anyway, so it's not like he's been stuck there. Like Woodley was saying, like, every time he sees Besser away from the net, he's wondering what's going on.
Yeah.
So I think you ought to do either, you should do either staple Besser to the net front and let him do his thing there. Or if you're going to move Besser around, then why not try to, like, Dakota Joshua is clearly your best net front forward on the team, certainly at even strength.
And one thing Tockett said last night that I thought was interesting when talking about the power play was that they need to get more shots and they need to get more gritty goals. And if you're talking about a guy that can get gritty goals around the net, that's Dakota
Joshua. Although, can I just say, like, I agree that an element of a really good power play is going to include gritty goals.
It's definitely not the main thing.
I don't know what you want. That's what you want to be prioritizing on the power play.
Especially when you have Elias Pettersson, Quinn Hughes, and JT.
Like, you look at the goals that Dallas scored on the power play last night. Like, those were products of, like, really high skill. And I think sometimes you think of, you know, we all heard the complaints, like, oh, they're passing it. They're looking for the perfect goal. They just have to shoot it. But the way you open up those really high danger scoring chances on the power play is by moving the puck, is by, you know, forcing the other team to get out of position. And that opens up the shooting lanes. I'm not saying that Rick Tocchet is telling them, like, oh, you just shoot the puck and try to get a tip in or whatever, but there has to be, like, gritty goals should be your backup option. Or, like, oh, we took a shot, now the puck's there, and we're going to get that gritty goal, rather than what you're aiming for on the power play.
And I think that's maybe why you put Joshua there, is like, hey, you still have the four guys who are extremely
who
skilled, they're
going
to pass it around, and then you have the backup option of, like, hey, if things aren't going well, or there's a scrum around the net, whatever, Dakota Joshua is a big guy. He can get the puck and he can score there. And that's why I'd like to see them try it. I don't know. The issue that comes up is not only is the third line minutes, especially when they're all playing together, that those are going up. Joshua's playing on the penalty kill as well. He's a main penalty killer. Can he be as effective if you're also making
when you're amping up the minutes like that? Yeah, that's a fair point as well. And I mean, really, so much of this hinges on Lindholm, right? Because if he's healthy and back, I think he's got to go into that spot on the power play. But, you know, with Dakota Joshua on the power play, I would so much, like, people text in all the time, right? Like, oh, Nikita Zadorov, put him on the net front. Like, no. At least with Dakota Joshua, yeah, he's not just a big body. He has that level of skill where if it's on a, you know, a zone entry on the power play or a retrieval or whatever, I have at least enough confidence that he can make a play. Because that's the thing. Like, with the fifth guy, it's not just enough to be big and go in front of the net. You still need to be able to make plays. You still need to be able to handle the puck under pressure in a way that Joshua can and Nikita Zadorov cannot.
Yeah, it's like the idea of it is so fun. It's like, oh, it's so big guy enticing. In front of the net. Dustin Bufflin.
Yeah, I know. It's like Dustin Bufflin was a forward when he was doing that against the Canucks.
Yeah, and then when they moved to defense, he played like the quarterback on
he
the
played
power
like
play.
A forward, yeah.
So, yeah, Joshua to me is the kind of the only big body I would try there. If you're not doing Joshua there, I think you keep Besser net front or Lindholm when he's back. And
yeah.
You got to play around with that, but... Really, the only guys I would like to see tried on the top power play unit for the rest of the season would be Joshua and Lindholm.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I know people have been clamoring for Hoglander, but I don't see the fit on power play one.
He just doesn't have a quality that makes him power play one.
That's the thing, right? There's just not a clear fit for them. As much as I love what he's done in the season, power play two, that's completely fine. Although power play two is really an afterthought at this point, but I don't see the fit there for him. On power play one, in terms of how they're lining up, you know, just at 5-on-5 to begin game, somebody texted in a little bit earlier, some Johnny Mack, who said against playoff teams, when the Canucks play their best offensive players against their Otona's top line, it reduces the odds for success. And then he says instead, what he wants to see is the Lotto line, the Bluger line. So he's given Bluger the nod at center. He's taking his he's taking it from Ray Ferraro there. Says the center is always the guy who gets the line named after him. But Lotto line, Bluger line, shutdown line of Mikheyev, Lindholm, and Suter. And then he says Hoglander, Lafferty, and Podkolzin on the fourth line. Now, the only thing I'd say there is that they haven't really played Lafferty at center at any point. So if you're going Lotto line, that probably means you're moving Suter down to the fourth line. But yeah. I got to say, like, if you start with, okay, we're going to keep Joshua, Bluger, and Garland together. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the Lotto. Like, look, we're dissatisfied with our top six. Let's just promote that line to second line status. Load up the Lotto line. Go full shutdown with Mikheyev, Lindholm, and, I don't know, either Lafferty or Hoglander.
Yeah.
And then go, like, Suter, Podkolzin, and whoever else, the other guy on the fourth line. I can think of a lot worse ideas than that. I know the Lotto line was like a blip, and Rick Tocchet even said at the time, like, don't get too attached to this. We're not going to do it for that long. They tailed off towards the end of the experiment. But I think that makes a lot of sense. I think Johnny Mack is onto something there about just divvying up the roles for the forward group a little bit better.
I could see that being something they go to, I want to say, in like desperation mode, because that kind of feels like what the Lotto line is at this point, is a desperation move.
It's not desperation time, but it's like, it's pressure time.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't want to say desperation, but do you want to wait until you're desperate, or do you want to go to it to help you not get into a desperate position? Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. I guess the issue is like, if the Lotto line does get shut down, because you know, that line is going to go up against the heaviest minutes. It's going to be a hard matchup. If they get shut down, are you confident in these other lines to create offense?
I mean, I think you have to be confident in the Bluger line at this point. If you're not confident in them, who are you going to be confident in?
I'm confident in them to an extent. I just don't know if I'm putting all my chips in that basket personally. And look, to Johnny Mack's text, like I wouldn't mind seeing this mix of personnel and see how it works. I just don't know. I don't know if it's conducive long term.
I just think it's, we're getting down to the nitty gritty time of the season, right? Where like the fact that Baines and Lafferty were in the top six, I think we all kind of looked at it as a curiosity. I think maybe
that
we should.
Silly.
Yeah. Well, I don't even want to say silly, because I understand where Tocchet's coming from. He's looking for answers, but I don't know how long you can leave the Lotto line kind of on the shelf as a break glass in case of emergency. Again, I don't want to say it's an emergency situation, but it's getting pretty, like, you're running out of time where you can fiddle. You got to start getting into, we believe that this can be a solution. If I'm putting these guys together, it's because I think it can really help us in a playoff series. And, like, I don't think Baines and Lafferty is that. I think the Lotto line could be that. Now, again, of course, so much of this depends on what happens with Elias Lindholm. And Mighty Stavros texted in, Lindholm has been battling a nagging injury. It's hurting his offensive production. Sitting him down to heal for the playoffs, given we have a points buffer in the standings, is brilliant.
Whoa.
The Canucks are playing chess here.
4D
chess?
That's
from Mighty Stavros. I don't know. Just chess.
Oh, man.
I disagree.
If he had, like, Like, yeah, I disagree too. If he had existing chemistry with players, I'd be like, hey, you know what? I get it.
Yeah.
He does not. He needs to, like, find players to play with, and that's more important than getting right.
And I'm all for getting him healthy. Like, I'm all for getting him healthy, especially if you think there was, like, an obvious connection between the struggles he was having and kind of the underwhelming performance and whatever injury he has, then yes, absolutely give him the time. I'm not saying rush him back, but if it's, unless it is like absolutely necessary for him to be sitting out to heal up here, I don't see why you would take him out of the lineup for essentially like load management issues when you desperately need to find him a spot in the lineup. I also just think you need to see in general what the lineup looks like for everyone else, right? Like what the domino effect is and where everyone else can go.
Because like even before this trade, we were talking about, hey, if they move Kuzmenko, which they did, you still have to add another top six forward.
Yep.
And so now you're missing the top
Kuzmenko
six.
And the guy you and got.
Exactly.
For him.
So now you're like down two top six forwards. And that's really, really difficult to overcome. And the Canucks just, they're simply not in a position where they can afford to rest guys unless they really need, like, they're really dealing with an injury. And so that's why I don't think it's like, hey, they're doing this on purpose.
I think there'd also just be a lot less mystery about it. Not that they would come out and say, like, we're going to rest him until the playoffs, but it would be like, he's day-to-day. Mm-hmm. Rather than, oh, maybe day-to-day, maybe, or we'll see.
He's talking
like,
to doctors and having appointments and stuff. We don't know what's going on.
Because you look at Demko, and it's like, all the reporting is, he's going to be back roughly here, you know, that's fine. They're not going to tell you what the injury is, but it's been very consistent since the initial news broke. Whereas with Lindholm, it's just kind of been all over the place. And that to me is not consistent with like, oh, this is all part of their master plan. Mm-hmm. I think everyone would rather have Lindholm healthy and playing in the lineup right now than whatever is happening right here. Where does Lindholm's status rank for you in terms of like biggest concerns heading into the playoffs for the Canucks right now? So, what's your number one concern? Is it the power play?
It's the power play.
Yeah.
And then
it has to be.
Then it's 5-on-5 scoring, I would say.
Yeah.
And then are you more concerned about Lindholm's injury or Demko's injury?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I think Lindholm because of the uncertainty, but that comes with a giant caveat that I don't like. It's going to be so fascinating to watch Thatcher Demko in the however many regular season games he gets back and to listen to, you know, what Kevin Woodley has to say about it and all of that. Because there's absolutely a world where Demko's, you know, fully healed, comes back, but sometimes it's really tough for a goalie to come back from an injury, even when they're cleared, right? Even when they're ready to play, there's no risk of re-injury. It's just a little off. If that's the case, obviously that's a doomsday scenario. Like, that's so much worse than not having Elias Lindholm available. But just the fact that, so, okay, week to week, he's going to be back here. It seems like everything is progressing fine. It gives me at least a little bit of confidence that Demko can come back, get a couple games in the regular season, and be kind of the Thatcher Demko they need him to be. Again, maybe even a little bit more rested. With Lindholm, I just have no idea what to think. I'm just like, I don't know. Like, is he, when's he going to play? How healthy is he? What the injury is? I can't even begin to handicap it.
Yeah. And then even if he is healthy, it's like, well, where's he going to
play? Where's he
going to
play
the
lineup?
Look,
how good is he going to be?
So there's definitely more like questions surrounding that. The thing I will say is my concern on Demko goes way up if he misses even like one more game than anticipated.
Mm.
Because then I'm like, oh, okay, maybe they thought it was going to be shorter and it went a little longer, and now you're running out of runway for him to really get going. And what I will say is, you think about the preseason and starting goalies play like three games. If he gets three games in, I'm not super concerned about it, but that's what I would say. They're probably 3A, 3B, not Quinn Hughes, 3B in terms of my concern level right now, Lindholm and Demko.
So does that mean we should actually be 3B, should actually be like number one with a bullet?
That's what I'm saying. Demko is 3B, but it might
but
be one.
But secretly number one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know because of IR, I think, or LTIR, the earliest he'd be able to return would be April 6th against LA.
And if he misses that game, then I'm like, okay,
well, no, I disagree with that because that's the last game of a three-game road trip.
I guess.
So that, like, don't put him in that. Let them come home.
No,
Monday.
I'm going to get really angry about it.
Monday, April 8th against Vegas. That, to me, is the point where you're allowed to be concerned.
Okay.
If they're, like, delaying it by like that. Because then you look at it. They have five games left. Play him against Vegas, give DeSmith the Coyotes, play him against Edmonton, give DeSmith the Flames, play him against Winnipeg. And that's like three out of five. He gets the good teams to get warmed up. You ease them back into the playoffs. I think that if that's how it plays out, that's kind of best case scenario for Thatcher Demko here.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I can get on board with that. But again, it rises up the ranks dramatically if things go wrong.
Yeah. Oh, look, in terms of things that could go wrong for the team, Thatcher Demko not being at his best is, you're right, probably should be a lot higher. I'm just, maybe it's pure cope, but I'm clinging to the idea that he will be at his best.
I believe
for
you
the
guys
playoffs.
Are telling the truth.
Yes, exactly. Kevin and Comox texts in, boys, as a lifelong Canucks fan, I will be equally as bummed if they don't find a way to bring back Zadorov as I was when they drafted Olli Juolevi over Tkachuk.
Equally?
Slow down
equally?
There a little. I mean, I guess he means in the moment, not with how it's developed since then.
Could you imagine? He's like, right now, I'm equally as mad about this as if you let Zadorov.
And I don't know. Zadorov, he's such an easy player to like.
Yeah.
Because it's so flashy and so loud. He's a fan favorite type of player. I also I would be way more scared of his next contract than Dakota Joshua's next contract.
Oh, for sure. So one thing that's I see on Twitter all the time is like, why would the Canucks want to sign Myers over Zadorov? It's because Zadorov's going to get $30 million.
It's because a salary cap exists. And yes. Zadorov's going to be signed for a lot more and a lot longer than Tyler Myers.
And that's a lot scarier than being like, hey, Tyler, here's a few million for a year or two.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. Look, if there's a way to get him back on a semi-team-friendly deal, I definitely explore it, but
I don't see it.
He seems like a guy that's going to get paid a lot of money.
Yeah. For all the reasons that fans are so excited here, he's going to be in heavily in demand come unrestricted free agency. All right, Josh, thank you, man. I appreciate it. Good luck with that Easter dinner.
Thank you.
To planning.
I'll figure it out.
Somebody texted in, if you don't want to do ham, do a nice leg of lamb.
Okay.
A leg of lamb is delicious. So
keep that in mind.
I can co-sign that one. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We are back on Monday. Canucks play Sunday against the Ducks. Keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.